The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Don Yosef Nossi and the Return of the Muranos, is dedicated to the memory, Leilu Nishmas, Andre Ashadov Neher, Olav Shalom, of blessed memory. The very word Murano carries with it a certain sense of excitement and mystique. People outwardly living like pious Catholics in their homes, away from the prying eyes of neighbors or church officials, living a secretive and dangerous Jewish existence. Although scholars have persuasively argued that, for the most part, the descendants of those Jews who were originally converted to Catholicism, especially in Spain, and did not take the opportunity of escaping and rejoining the mainstream Jewish community, severed their Jewish ties and became sincere practicing Catholics. There also exists ample proof, though, that for centuries a core group of Muranos, centered in Portugal, persisted in maintaining their Jewishness well up until the 20th century. In the year 1917, M. Samuel Schwartz, a Jewish mining engineer from Poland, who was then based in Lisbon, Portugal, was on a mining expedition to the Serra da Estrela, a formidable mountain range in the far north of the country, which separates the town of Belmonte from the rest of Portugal. While visiting Belmonte to buy supplies, he was warned by one merchant not to have anything to do with one of his competitors. Quote, "It's enough for me to tell you that that man is a Jew," end quote. This bit of information stirred Schwartz's curiosity. He began befriending the so-called Jewish merchant. The man told him of the existence of an entire Murano community in Belmonte. Unfortunately, since that Jewish merchant had married a non-Jewish Catholic woman, he was not trusted by the other Muranos. He did his best, however, to try to introduce Schwartz to the other Muranos by confidentially telling them, "E dos nosos, he's one of us." But they were very suspicious and were very skeptical of Schwartz's claim that he was Jewish. Being isolated from other Jews for over 400 years, they had no knowledge of Jews outside of Portugal, and after all, Schwartz was unlike any of the Muranos, the secret Jews with whom they were raised. The most compelling argument against his Jewishness was that Schwartz did not know the secret Portuguese prayers of the Muranos. In vain, Schwartz tried to explain to them that the universal language of prayer for Jews the world over was Hebrew, with which he was fluent, and not Portuguese. The Muranos, unfortunately, had never heard of Hebrew, and therefore doubted its existence. Finally, an old woman, whom the group treated with particular reverence, told him, quote, "Since you claim to have different prayers from ours, at least recite a Jewish prayer in the Hebrew language that you assure us is used by other Jews." Naturally, Schwartz chose the passage that is known to Jews throughout the world, Shema Yisroel. And he said, it's Hashem's name, Adon. This is Elokeinu, Adon, Echod, O Hero Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. The Muranos were unfamiliar with the passage itself. However, as soon as he pronounced Hashem's name, the Adon word, they placed their hands over their eyelids, as Jews throughout the world do when saying Shema. The old woman turned to the assembled and said, quote, "He is indeed a Jew, for he knows the name Adon." I know they pronounce it the way it should be pronounced. This vestige of the Lashon HaKodesh, the Hebrew language, is almost all that remained with these people. From that moment on, Schwartz gained access to the remaining Murano communities spread throughout the remote northern provinces of Portugal. Long the subject of persecution and discrimination, and isolated from the general Jewish world over the years, they had developed a clandestine but stunted form of Judaism. Although it seems that in the capital, Lisbon, and the greater cities in the western part of Portugal, any form of Jewish life had long been stamped out by the Inquisition, those still committed to Judaism after the introduction of the Inquisition were either exterminated by the church or managed to emigrate. In the far northeast of that country, however, away from the major population centers and the center of the Inquisition, Jewish life in some form was much easier to maintain. For these people, often very poor, yet still committed, emigration from the country was extremely difficult. So under the circumstances, they adopted a form of Judaism that survived for well over 400 years. Outwardly, they lived like Catholics. For baptisms, weddings, and funerals, they attended church. As one priest stated, quote, going to church was part of their religion, end quote. On the other hand, in private, they steadfastly denied that Yeshu was the Messiah, nor did they recognize the many saints of the Catholic Church. They considered themselves Jews who were forced to outwardly act like Christians. They maintained their sense of community by marrying only amongst themselves and through mutual charity and generosity at times of need. They also met at regular intervals for prayer. Their connection to Judaism and the rest of the Jewish people, of whom they had lost contact, was evident in the standard form of their benedictions, which they said in Portuguese, Blessed art thou, my Lord, my Adon, they would say Hashem's name, who has commanded us with his blessed and holy commandments that we do, and then after describing the mitzvah, they would continue, as our brethren do in the land of promise, referring to Eretz Yisrael. So they never sever their ties, to, in a sense, to world Jewry. The prayers were generally handed down orally from generation to generation and were relatively few in number. As far as we know, a complete compilation of the entire Murano liturgy would only fill some 40 printed pages. In addition, Tehillim psalms, which were accessible to all Catholics in the Vulgate, in the Latin version of the Bible, served for many Muranos as a rich reservoir of liturgical material as well as a source of comfort and inspiration. Instead of the Catholic formula at the end of the recitation of the Psalms, Gloria Patri, of the Holy Father, they would conclude in the name of the Lord Adon, and they say Amen. The principal repository of these traditions seemed to have been the women. On these occasions, when prayer meetings were held, it was generally led by elderly women who acted as the spiritual guides of their communities. But men were also involved in keeping Judaism alive and also passed down their traditions to their progeny. One descendant of Muranos, Captain Arthur Carlos de Barros Basto, they generally have long names. And it's interesting, even the Muranos who escaped and maintained their Jewishness in Amsterdam but maintained their Sephardic connections also had inordinately long names. So this Captain Arthur Carlos de Barros Basto, who died in 1961 at the age of 74, told over how his grandfather, who died when he was only 10, taught him to say the following formula whenever he had to go into a church. Quote, In this house I enter, I adore neither the wood nor the stone, but one God who governs all the world. Touching his brow, he would say Adon, he would say Hashem's name, my God in my thoughts. Now touching his lips, he would say Adonai, this is my God on my lips. And touching his chest, he would say Adon, this is my God in my heart. When performed rapidly, this gesture resembles the sign of the cross made by Catholics as they enter the church. The prayers of the Muranos were almost entirely in Portuguese. Almost no Hebrew was preserved by them, with the exception of a few words. Hashem's name, as we said before, Adon. The word goyo, from the Hebrew goy, which refers to non-Jews. Entrafada, from the Hebrew trefa, which refers to something impure or not kosher. Some of the prayers contain Hebrew in a garbled form. One prayer reads, Sabbat Malkol Orez Kabrado, which in the original Hebrew reads, you know, Ado means Hashem, Tzavakos Melo Koloritz Kavodo. You know, the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory, which is part of the Kedusha prayer, said every day, three, four times a day. Unfortunately, the Muranos recited these words mechanically without any idea of their meaning. Although much was forgotten, many ceremonies were still preserved in some form. For instance, the Muranos preserved the ceremony of Netilas Yadayim, washing hands before davening, before prayer. Facing the east, Mizrach, while praying, also survived. Covering the head during prayer with a white cloth, presumably in imitation of the talis, managed to survive up to a very late period. The Catholic influence was also felt as kneeling during prayers became so prevalent that it was mentioned in their liturgy. Originally, it seems that some of the Muranos were careful to only eat meat that was ritually slaughtered, was geschachten, although the shochtim, the ritual slaughterers of that period, were also baptized, so they're also secret Jews. Later, because of the unrelenting pressures of the church, it fell into disuse. It seems that they tried not to eat the gid hanosha, the sciatic nerve, which was removed whenever it could be done without arousing suspicion from their servants. Meat was regularly washed to remove traces of blood, as they couldn't do the salting, but at least they did the washing. Originally, the Muranos would totally refrain from eating chazer, pork. But under the watchful eye of the Inquisition, it became increasingly more difficult for them to refrain from pork altogether, which was a staple in a large part of the Iberian Peninsula. It was customary for them to refrain from pork, at least on Shabbos, as well as during the month preceding Pesach, Passover, as well as the month before Yom Kippur. The Muranos were also very careful to observe Shabbos during those months, of, you know, between, you know, Purim and Pesach and before Yom Kippur, although in general Shabbos observance had fallen into disuse. In fact, they were so careful to observe these mitzvahs during the period before Passover and Yom Kippur, they created special takonas, special rules. For instance, if a Murana was traveling that month and couldn't avoid eating pork, he was barred from the Passover meals. He had to sit apart, eat from a separate plate, was not even allowed to sleep with his wife during the Passover week, as considered tainted and impure. Nor was he allowed to eat the special matzah, or peo santo, holy bread, that was baked on Pesach. To avoid suspicion from the church authorities, the Muranos did not begin the celebration until the third day of Pesach. The first 2 days, however, they were forbidden to eat chometz, leavened bread. On the morning of the third day, the Muranos would throw little balls of dough into the oven and wait for them to explode. The explosions were taken as a good omen. This was their way of taking challah, the portion of the dough which is separated and burned. When baked, the specially baked matzah on leavened bread was considered holy, hence peo santo, and it was not allowed to be thrown away. Uneaten portions were kept for the following year, and what could not be preserved was burned. Murano girls were sometimes given pieces as wedding presents and would keep them in small boxes for the rest of their lives. Although in many respects the Muranos preserved the original tradition of their ancestors, there are also, however, some differences. Without the benefit of a Jewish calendar, the Muranos kept the standard date for Passover, the 14th day after the new moon that occurred between March and April. Very often that date was the true date of Passover. Other times, it wasn't. Throughout the week of Passover, the Muranos who lived in the vicinity of Belmonte would go out on picnics in order to pray in private. The most important gathering took place on the final morning, Shvi Shel Pesach, the seventh day of Passover, on the banks of the Rio Zezera in northern Portugal. Prayers and hymns were recited, including a special prayer that recounts the story of Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea. When they would reach the words of this special prayer, quote, then Moshe came and lifted his staff to beat on the salty waters, end quote. The assembles would strike the water with olive branches and repeat the next line in unison, quote, the sea opens in a dozen roads, my people will pass in safety, end quote. This, by the way, is based upon the Medrash, that the sea split into 12 paths, one for each of the Shvatim, the tribes. The olive branches, the, you know, the beat on the waters, were saved for the following year when they were used to light the ovens for baking the Pao Santa, the holy matzah. Like, it's similar to the custom of preserving the lulav and to throw into the fire when we burn the chometz. So, Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the Murano calendar. They call it Dia Grande, the great day, or Dia Puro, pure day, which seems to be a corruption from Yom Kippur. All Muranos, even though they're religiously lax, fasted in Yom Kippur. The more religious gather together five times to pray. They celebrated on the 11th day of the new moon of September. It seems that they chose that day rather than the 10th, as they chose the 11th, which is mandated by the Torah, in order to avoid suspicion. The day before the fast, they would bathe, similar in a sense to our practice, you know, of going to the mikveh. In the evenings, candles were lighted in abundance for both the living and the dead, and they were placed upon clean white cloths. Never Shabbos, lighting the lamps for Shabbos remained an essential mitzvah for them. After sundown on Friday night, the family would gather together for a brief ceremony, and the women would cover their heads with napkins or white cloth. The lamps were made from tin by Murano craftsmen, and the wicks from seven strands of pure linen. An old Murano woman would spin each strand from the whitest flax she could find and blessed each one individually. Before they were lit, curtains were drawn, and the lamps sometimes hidden in pots. The bracha, the blessing recited, resembles somewhat the standard bracha, but in Portuguese. Blessed be my God, my Lord, my Ado, who ordains us and commands us with his blessed and most holy commandments to kindle this holy wick. They also maintain distinctive mourning customs. The first meal after the burial consists of hard-boiled eggs, which was served to them by a stranger, which is consistent with the halacha. During the Shiva, the week of mourning, they would remain home and would avoid eating meat during the entire period. This custom originally originated because they felt that even though they couldn't faithfully keep the laws of kashrus during the week, it was only proper for them to keep them during the period of mourning. Since it became impossible for the Muranos to obtain kosher meat, they refrained during this period from eating meat altogether. In addition, on the day before and after a fast day, meat was also avoided. During the period of Shiva, tzedakah charity was dispensed, and on the last day of Shiva, they would fast. One particular fast that had special place for the Muranos was the fast of Esther. It was generally observed on the full moon of February, and is precisely a month before Passover. In others being February and March, that new moon, which would be, according to their calculations, a month before, Pesach, and would inaugurate the special observance of that month. In other words, once they started fasting, then they had the special observance. They didn't eat pork or whatever. To them, Esther represented the quintessential Murano. Hiding her real identity, she still remained loyal to her Jewish roots. On that day, they would recite the prayer of Esther. Although it does not contain the traditional Hebrew or Masoretic book of Esther, Megillas Esther, it is nonetheless, as this prayer of Esther, part of the Vulgate, the Latin version of the Bible. Since the possession of Hebrew books was outlawed by the church, the Muranos' only source of scriptures was the Latin version of the Bible. It contained not only Tanakh, the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, but also the Apocrypha, material which was composed during the post-biblical period. Although these works are not considered sacred by Jewish tradition, they were preserved in the Catholic Bible. The Book of Esther in the Vulgate version is a much expanded version of the original and contains this prayer of Esther. As you will see, the Muranos identified very much with Esther and her prayer. The setting of this prayer is in the midst of Esther's fast right before she was about to come to Ahasuerus. And I think it's just so moving, I'd like to quote the entire prayer. And it was very often a sign of the Muranos. They would know this by heart. I mean, it's a very long prayer, but they would know this by heart. End quote. And she prayed unto the Lord God of Israel, saying, O my Lord, our King, you stand alone. Help me who am alone and have no helper but you. for my danger is in my hand. Ever since I was born, I have heard in the tribe of my family that you, Lord, took Israel from among all the nations and our forefathers from among all their ancestors for an everlasting possession, and that you did for them all that you promised. But now we have sinned before you, and you have handed us over to our enemies because we glorified their gods. And you could see, understand how it connected to them. You are upright, Lord. And now they are not satisfied that we are in bitter captivity, but they have made an agreement with their idols to abolish what your mouth has ordained and destroy your possession and stop the mouths of those who praise you and quench the glory of your house and your altar and open the mouths of the heathen to praise unreal gods so that a mortal being may be magnified forever. I mean, in the prayer it refers to Haman, but you could understand in their meaning it refers to Yeshua. Lord, do not give up your scepter to those who have no being, and do not let them mock at our fall, but turn their plan against themselves and make an example of the man who has begun this against us. Remember, Lord, make yourself known in this time of our affliction and give me courage. King of the gods and holder of all domain, put eloquent speech in my mouth before this lion and change his heart to hate the man, Nezachishver should hate Haman, who is fighting against us, so that there may be an end of him and of those who support him. But save us by your hand and help me who stand alone and have no one but you, O Lord. You know everything, and you know that I hate the splendor of the wicked and abhor the bed of the uncircumcised, of any alien. You know what I am forced to do, that I abhor the symbol of my proud position, which is placed upon my head on the days when I appear in public. I abhor it as the crown, like a filthy rag, and never wear it in private. Your servant has not eaten at Haman's table, and I have not honored the king's feast or drunk the wine of the libations. Your servant has had no joy from the day I was brought here until now, except in you, Lord, God of Abraham, O God, whose might is over all. Hear the voice of the despairing and save us from the hands of the evildoers and save me from what I fear. End quote. As soon as Samuel Schwartz, the engineer who had discovered the remnants of the Murano community in Belmonte, was recognized by them as being a Jew, for as we mentioned, he knew the secret name of God, you know, Adon, he began to access the many remaining Muranos and outlying communities of northern Portugal. He studied their traditions, ceremonies, and prayers. He also discovered manuscripts of Murano prayers which had been transcribed in the early 1800s after the Inquisition was no longer in force. It was up until that time, it was a balpe. It was just kept orally. They were afraid to write down anything. After the Inquisition was abolished, at least they had the courage, I mean, to write it down. He described his discoveries in a book that he published in the year 1925 titled, quote, The New Christians in Portugal in the 20th Century. There was much excitement throughout the Jewish world as they now became aware of the existence of those remnants of Sephardic Jewry. In 1926, a year after Schwartz published his book, Jewish organizations in London and Paris, at the behest of the Lisbon Jewish community, decided to initiate measures that would bring the Muranos back to the mainstream of Jewish life. They chose as their emissary a noted journalist from the Times of London by the name of Lucien Wolff, a man who was well known for his organizing on behalf of the League of Nations, relief aid for the refugees after World War I. After doing much research and speaking with all those concerned, including the present Prime Minister of Portugal, Wolff decided that the only place where it would be feasible to start such a program would be Oporto, Portugal. That small Jewish community there was being led by a descendant of Muranos who had converted to Judaism. The aforementioned is Captain Arthur Carlos de Barros Bastos. His mother was a so-called old Christian, a native Portuguese Christian. His father, however, was a new Christian, a Murano, a descendant of the Jews who had secretly maintained their Jewishness. It was from his paternal grandfather that he learned of his Jewish roots. Captain Arthur Carlos de Barros Bastos was born in the year 1887. After World War I, where he served with distinction, and the subsequent death of his mother, Barros Bastos went to Tangiers, where he was circumcised and embraced Judaism. On his return, he married the daughter of a prominent Jewish family in Lisbon. Back in his hometown of Oporto, where he served as a governor of a military prison, he organized a congregation from the few foreign Jews who settled there. As Lucian Wolff described, quote, "Of this congregation, he," Barlos Bastos, "is president, chazan, treasurer, secretary, and general fairy godmother." It was here that Wolff felt that the Muranos would have their best chance in returning to Judaism. In Wolff's words, quote, "For me, the great attraction of Oporto is that it is the seat of a small Jewish community which was presided over and managed by the one Murano who in the last 150 years has re-entered the synagogue. As an ex-Murano himself, he knows the Murano psychology better than anyone else in the Portuguese Jewish community." That's because all the Jews in Portugal at the time were really immigrants. I mean, they weren't native Jews. I mean, they had come from North Africa or whatever. Barros Bastos converted his first Muranos later in that year, 1926, and in early 1927. Over the next decade, he toured the towns and villages of the Northeast, organizing the Muranos and running prayer meetings. Synagogues were opened in Bragança and two other towns, Cofilo and Pinhel. Barros Bastos also published a newspaper, Halapid, The Torch. In 1929, he brought five teenage boys to Oporto to teach them traditional Judaism. From this developed the Rosh Pina Jewish Theological Seminary, where 90 Murano youths were educated over the next decade. He also built a magnificent synagogue in Oporto, which could hold over 500 people. He had great dreams. It was funded through the generosity of a Shanghai philanthropist, Eli Kaduri. Despite all of these efforts, it was a massive failure. The synagogue remained largely empty. Virtually none of the students of the yeshiva remained faithful to Judaism. Barros Bastos' own daughter married a Catholic. Many are the theories of why this ambitious project failed. Perhaps the prophetic words of Lucian Wolff were fulfilled, and this is what he wrote, quote, "Whatever is done, it must not take the form of a noisy and aggressive propaganda. In the eyes of the church, the great bulk of the Muranos are still its baptized children, and anything in the shape of an offensive propaganda for converting them to Judaism would be bitterly resented." As one editorial in a Catholic paper later wrote, quote, "With outside money, they had built synagogues and teaching establishments called, quote-unquote, seminaries to feed this Jewish propaganda in the centers in which the descendants of the ancient New Christians live, jeopardizing the religious peace and moral unity of the Portuguese nation," end quote. After having lived dual lives for so many hundreds of years, the Muranos were reluctant to openly embrace Judaism in the face of open hostility of the church and Portuguese society. It's quite likely, though, that even today in the remote city of Belmonte and its environs, there still remains Muranos who practice their own native form of Judaism. We'll have to wait for Mashiach to bring the final remnant home. Yeah. Up until now, I have spoken about Jews who only practice Catholicism outwardly. In actuality, they were practicing Jews who were committed to a form of Judaism. These people were practicing Jews. I mean, outwardly, they were Christians. Some Murano practices have survived, however, amongst committed Catholics who are not even aware of their Jewish roots. For instance, some years ago, The New Yorker magazine described how a visitor to a distinguished Spanish noble family witnessed with astonishment that on Friday night, the master of the house turned around the pictures of the saints to face the wall. The nobleman did not know the reason why his family had this very strange custom. It would seem that this nobleman was a descendant of Muranos, who originally turned around these pictures at the time they lit candles or made Kiddush. Eventually, they became totally assimilated, and this custom, whose reason had become lost with time, was all that remained. I also read of a Jew who lived in Cuba before the revolution, who had hired a young Catholic girl as a domestic servant. A few days before Yom Kippur, the girl's mother came to the house and asked for the day off on behalf of her daughter. She explained, quote, "In our family, we did not work on the fast of the Jews," end quote. With a little more questioning, discovered that on Friday night, she used to light two candles in a tin box with holes punched in the top, and during the month of September, she did so for an entire week. The ironic end of the story was that the employer, who was an observant Jew, fired her because he needed a Shabbos goy. She evidently no longer qualified. Up until now, I have spoken about those forced Muranos and their descendants, those who did not manage to escape. Over the centuries, however, many actually did escape and join the mainstream Jewish communities throughout the world, enriching themselves and the world and world Jewry in the process. One outstanding example is the great Mekubal, Jewish mystic, Rav Yaakov Tzemach, who was born in Portugal to a family of Anusim, new Christians, and left his family in a career as a physician and rejoined the Jewish community in Salonika. From there, he traveled to Tzaf at Tzvas, where after many years of study, he succeeded in becoming a Talmudic scholar. From there, he moved to Damascus, where he studied Kabbalah under the great Rav Shmuel Vital, Rav Chaim Vital's son, eventually returning back to Eretz Yisrael, becoming one of the generation's greatest teachers of Kabbalah. I would like to devote the next part of this lecture to the story of a family whose special place in Jewish history is almost without rival. This is the story of the family Mendez, or Nossi, one of the wealthiest families of Europe, who after escaping Catholic Europe and joining the Jewish community of Constantinople, became Jewry's greatest benefactors. The 16th century was an age of powerful women. Mary Tudor and Elizabeth reigned in England, Mary Queen of Scots in Scotland, in Italy, Lucrezia Borgia, Caterina Sforza, Isabella d'Este, Vittoria Colonna, wielded much power. Catherine de' Medicis of Florence, Italy, who became the wife of King Henry II and the mother of three of France's monarchs, Francis II, Charles IX, and Henry III, played a major part in France's government. What these women had in common, however, was they were born into royal and noble families and inherited not only their wealth, but their positions of power. And it was by their power that they are known. History books are full of their machinations, the wars that they launched, and the intrigues with which they were involved. They're not filled with stories of their tzidkus, saintliness, or charity, in all probability, because there was virtually nothing to write about. It is noteworthy that in that same century, a Jewish woman rose to extraordinary heights. Not only is she known by her wealth and power, but also by her charity and kindness. This woman was Dona Gracia Nossi. At a time when Jews were by and large the subjects of discrimination and persecution, often hunted by the church, she gave them dignity, protection, and alleviated their suffering, and helped escaping Muranos to find a safe haven. This is how Samuel Usku, the author of Consolation of Israel, described her. The Lord sent her down in our days from the midst of his holy angels and united every virtue in one person. For your happiness, it was that he has placed this soul in the lovely form of the blessed Jewess, Nossi. She it was who at the beginning of the dispersion of the Muranos gave strength and hope to your perishing sons, made hopeless by their want of means to escape the fire, encouraged them to go forth on their pilgrimage. With bountiful hand did she succor those who had already set out on their wanderings in Flanders and other parts, and who, weakened by poverty and overcome by the perils of sea passage, were in danger of getting no further, and strengthened them in their need. She did not withhold her favor even from her enemies. With her pure hand and her heavenly will, she has freed most of this nation of Muranos from the depths of endless misery, poverty, and sin, led them into safe places, and gathered them together into obedience to the precepts of the true God. Thus did she become your strength, referring to the Jewish people, in your weakness. She was born in the year 1509 or 1510 to the Nasi family. This family had fled Spain and came to Portugal in 1492 and were converted to Catholicism in 1497. Her Hebrew name was Hana, or the translation was Gracia in Portuguese. Her Christian name was Beatriz de Luna. Her brother Shmuel was the personal physician of the King of Portugal. At the age of 18, she married Francisco Tzemach Mendez, a man twice her age, who was the head of one of the most powerful mercantile and banking houses in all of Europe. Its main office was in Lisbon, Portugal, under Francisco's auspices, and his branch office in Antwerp, what was then Flanders, which was part of the Spanish Netherlands. And it was under the management of Francisco's younger brother, Diogo, or Mayor Mendez. The firm lent money to the emperors, kings, and nobility of Europe, including the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and the French King Francis I. The Mendes were Muranos, secret Jews like the Nossis. Their original family name, it seems, and there's a question, was Benveniste. As years went by, it was ever more difficult for converted Jews like the Mendes family to practice their faith in private. Despite all of their efforts to bribe the temporal religious leaders of Christendom, at the end of the year 1531, the Inquisition was formally introduced into Portugal. After Francisco's death, sometimes around the year 1536, Gracia Hana, together with her younger daughter Reina, or Briandina, a younger sister Malca Reina, or the Portuguese name is Brianda de Luna, and several young nephews, sons of her late brother, took the opportunity and left Portugal and the fires of the Inquisition and traveled to Antwerp to join her brother-in-law, Diogo. Her sister soon afterwards married her brother-in-law, Diogo, and her two nephews went on to attend the University of Louvain. After completing university, one of her nephews, Joao, or Josef Miguez, joined the Spanish army, and after a brief stint as a cavalry officer, he joined the family firm. After her brother Diogo passed away in the year 1542, Hana Gracia was designated in her brother-in-law's will as a trustee of his will and the head of the Mendes banking house. Her nephew, Joao, assumed direction of the day-to-day operation of the firm. During this time, Gracia, Hana, also headed the Mendes' elaborate underground rescue organization for Murano refugees, as alluded to in the quotation from Samuel Usku's work. The firm's network of business agents moved through Italy and the Balkans and sent back information on promising escape routes to the Ottoman Empire and the location of quote-unquote safe houses and inns. So it was like an underground railroad. You can appreciate it was very difficult for Gracia to maintain the facade as a religious Catholic and hide her connection to Judaism in her capacity as one of the most powerful women in Europe. A story is told when the Queen Regent in the Netherlands, this is Maria, the sister of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, solicited the hand of her daughter, Reina, for one of her court favorites. Gracia replied that she would rather see her daughter dead. She was very much a Yiddish mama. This incredible refusal, coupled with the general suspicion of the Muranos in Flanders, made it all the more advisable for her to seek a safer environment. In fact, the family was already under suspicion of being secret Jews, and the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, had already put Diogo under house arrest previously on two separate occasions. He was released both times through the intercession of Antwerp's mercantile community. But upon Diogo's death, Charles decreed that all the records and assets of the Mendes firm be impounded, claiming that he was a Judaizer. The Judaizer is a secret Jew, and by law he had the right to expropriate all of his assets. Gracia had to expend much money in bribes and legal fees in order to retain control of the firm. In addition, she lent the emperor a tremendous sum of money to be repaid within 2 years. At the end of that time, after much effort and expense, the see to it the loan was finally repaid. On November of the year 1544, Gracia finally, so the loan was repaid, so she had that money. Gracia finally fled Antwerp together with her sister and their daughters, telling everyone that she was vacationing in Aix-la-Chapelle, which is on the Rhine River near the border of Belgium and Germany. She actually traveled to Lyon, France, and from them over the Alps to Italy, finally settling in Venice. During the two previous years, she was able to convert a sizable portion of the company's assets into jewels, which she carried with her. So she basically had millions of dollars in jewels. In addition, since taking control of the firm's activities, Jehoa had also managed to transfer many of the firm's assets out of the country. Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, upon hearing of her escape, was furious. He ordered the remainder of the Mendes estate to be impounded. There was, however, recourse for the Mendes under law, and legal proceedings to protect the assets dragged on for over a year. During that time, Joao Joseph managed to convert additional assets into bills of exchange on Italian banks. So he kept on converting everything as these legal proceedings were taking place. Then suddenly, before the case was resolved in the courts, Joao himself disappeared, following his aunt's secret route across the Alps to Venice, Italy. Although he had to sacrifice much of the Mendes estate, the family still was in possession of a vast fortune. There in Venice, Gracia encountered much difficulty, as we'll soon discuss. But through the advice and assistance of her nephew, Joao, in dealing with the authorities, as well as the influence of the Sultan Suleiman, through Moshe Hamon, the Sultan's physician, she was able eventually to leave Venice with much of her property intact, and moved first to Ferrara, Italy, and eventually to Constantinople in the year 1553. Her arrival to Constantinople was noteworthy. As historians describe it, she thundered into the city with a caravan of four magnificently gilded coaches, pulled by a team of sleek horses and flanked by three dozen uniformed bodyguards and an elaborate entourage of family members and retainers. Shortly afterwards, in 1554, Joao Miguez, who had temporarily remained behind to complete all the arrangements, came to join them. It was there in Constantinople that the entire Nossi family openly embraced Judaism. Joao married his cousin Reina and changed his name to Joseph Nossi. He rose in the court of the Sultan and became next to the king the most powerful man in all of Turkey. While Joseph Nossi assumed responsibility for the family's business activities, Gracia, or Donna Gracia, the nobleman Gracia she was known, devoted herself to the welfare of her people. She rescued hostages and supported yeshivas, synagogues, hospitals, individual scholars and writers. Through her philanthropy, she wielded influence in her community to an extent which was unparalleled by any Jewish woman in the history of the diaspora. There were serious halachic or legal issues regarding the estate of her deceased husband and brother-in-law, however, which was brought before Moshe Trani, the Mabit, one of the leading rabbis in Tzfas, for judication. The following passages are taken from his tshuva, his response. I just want to touch upon this, because it's important from a legal thing, and it really fills us in with many of the historic details here. And it's on page 3 of your handouts. This is the response of Moshe Troni in regard to the case where two forced converts, Anusim, got married according to the laws of the land and the conditions they made in their ksuba. At the time of death, however, the husband ordered that the property be divided in a different manner. That's the summation of the question here. The question in particular is regarding a certain man, Reuven. When they refer to anonymous people, they generally, as in the Talmud itself, one is they give a name Reuven and the other they give a name Shimon. It's not their real names. Here, the Reuven here is this Francisco or Tzemach Mendez. One of the Anusim, who was forcibly converted subsequent to the Spanish decree. He married a woman by the name of Chana, which is Beatriz de Luna or Gracia. While there in exile. This was in Lisbon, Portugal. They agreed at a time of marriage that if he would die in her lifetime, the property would divide it in half. Half to her and half to any sons or daughters that he would have. The law, which applied equally to all the citizens in the realm, was that the person on his deathbed had the right to reapportion his property and give away a third of his property to whomever he desires from the half that was designated for the children. The half that was designated for the wife, as well as the two-thirds of the half of the children, could in no way be reapportioned. Now, according to Portuguese law, he really only had he only had the ability to give a sixth away. There's a half was to the wife, and two-thirds were to the children. And the other third, if not reapportioned, would also be to the children, but if Portugal could go to someone else. That was Portuguese law, and that was the understanding when they made the ketubah originally. After some years, Reuven passed away. This is Francisco, in that country, amongst Gentiles, leaving one daughter from his wife Hannah, whose name was Sora. Unless he doesn't call her by her name. This is the Briandina, was the Portuguese name, or Reina, called Pelirina, was the Hebrew name. The deceased had a younger brother whose name was Shimon, and there's always Reuven and Shimon. Over here, this was Diogo, which is mayor, who lived in Flanders. While he was still alive, Shimon served as his commercial agent, investing all that was sent him. Reuven, at the time of his death, made a will, leaving considerable property to Shimon. Really, so he changed the ksuba, but it went against Portuguese law. After some time, Hannah left Portugal and came to her brother-in-law in Flanders, together with her daughter, Sora, and Hannah's sister, Rivka. Again, Rivka is a name has been changed to protect the innocent here. Her name was Brianda de Luna, or Malca Reina. After their arrival, Shimon married Rivka and had a daughter named Dina, which was Beatrizina, was her Portuguese name, or Gracia. It's interesting that there was a medal that was made while they were in Venice, which is a likeness of this Dina. It was then that Hannah asked Shimon to write out and personally sign a detailed list of her deceased husband's assets. Shimon agreed and wrote on the backside of her husband's will a detailed description of the properties. In addition, he wrote that he owned, according to the terms of the will of his deceased brother, half of all the property. Again, if it was this half, it goes against the understanding originally and against Portuguese law. And that Hannah and Sora owned the other half. Afterwards, Hannah asked Shimon that he either leave Flanders and accompany her to Alemania, which is northern Italy, or to some other place, or that he give her share of the property. Now, she wanted to leave. So at least, you know, that I should have money, so at least we should split it. Shimon wrote a document to that effect and promised that he would travel with her within the year, or if for some reason he couldn't, he would give her share of the property as was specified in Reuven's will. Before the year came to a close, Shimon passed away. At his deathbed, he made a will, said that half of all the property belonged to him, as Reuven had specified in his will. From his half, the alimony that he promised his wife Rivka at the time of his marriage should be paid, and his ksuba. All of the rest should be given to his only child, his daughter Dina. After Shimon died, the emperor decreed that the accounting books and all the properties of the Mendez family be seized, as we had explained before, and expropriated, since there was evidence that Shimon had been guilty of secretly practicing Judaism. Expropriation of property was the punishment meted out to all Judaizers. Hannah, this is Gracia, the trustee of her brother-in-law's property, was forced to spend enormous sums in order that the emperor drop the case and not seize Shimon's property. During this period, she also granted the emperor a large loan in order to appease him. After 2 years, when the emperor had finally repaid his loan after much effort and expense on her part, Hannah, her daughter Sora, her sister Rivka, and her niece Dina all left Flanders and came to Italy. This was done out of fear the emperor might accuse them of other allegations. When the emperor found out that they had fled together with all of their property, he was incensed and gave an order that any property within his realm belonging to the forenamed women should be seized, for they were all Judaizers. Because of this, Khanna was forced to distribute enormous sums in order to keep the emperor away from their property. And as that was that year that he was trying to work, Yosef was trying to work. After they came to Venice, Rivka, her sister, told the government and judicial courts of Venice how her sister Khanna and her niece Sora wished to go to Turkey and openly practice Judaism. She was a Mosser. She had told that they were secret Jews. Since she and her daughter Dina wished to remain Catholics in Venice, she wanted to be named the trustee of the estate of her daughter Dina. Both sisters came to court to settle this issue. Khanna retorted that her deceased brother-in-law Shimon had appointed her as sole trustee over all the property. He absolutely did not want his wife Rivka to have anything to do with the business, as was evident in his will. Evidently, he really knew her. In addition, during this time, there occurred the following incident. Rivka, the wife of the aforementioned Shimon, commanded her agent to take possession of a large part of the family's holdings in France, as their holdings was distributed all across Europe, claiming that they belonged to her daughter Dina. She appointed as her agent a Frenchman, a descendant of the evil Esav, who was a real anti-Semite, someone who was recognized by all as being a totally depraved individual and an informer against Jews. This person was not satisfied by what was being paid for his efforts by Rivka, the wife of Shimon. And as a result, he returned to France and informed the government that the two sisters and their daughters were clandestine Jews. Which would mean that they would be able to expropriate all of their property. Khanna, as Grassi, was forced to expend enormous amounts of money in order to counter these charges, as well as to regain the French properties that were taken from her by Rivka. All of this was done through the advice of Avram, I'm not sure who this is, and Yosef, which is Yosef Miguez, in other words, this Joea. Furthermore, Khanna had to spend very large sums of money to get the charges and Rivka's claim in Venice dismissed. She also had to pay monies in order to be released from jail, as they had imprisoned her out of fear that she would escape. Now Khanna, as Gracia, the wife of Reuven, and Sora, her daughter, have come to seek refuge under the wings of the Shekhinah to the kingdom of Turkey to openly practice Judaism, have to come to ask regarding all of the above. She claims, as the claim is, the basic question was really twofold. First of all, was the change that Francisco made in the will before he died valid? Or no, it was really, he had no right to change that will. That's the first question. The second question was that all of the monies that were expended by Gracia in order to, and in every situation, in order to, because of Rivka, to get out of the courts, because to deal with the thing in France, would be taken out of Rivka's share. That's why should she suffer? There was a tremendous amount of monies that were needed for these court proceedings and the bribes. So she felt that Rivka should pay for this. In other words, she goes into the tshuva. She claims that although from the time of Reuven's death she was aware of his will, the counter was, but you're quiet, you acquiesced. Her silence did not indicate her acquiescence to her late husband's will, as the bulk of the assets were in Shimon's hands. She was afraid that if she protested the will, her brother-in-law would then take the initiative and summarily take the portion that the deceased brother had allotted him. In other words, so she wanted to keep quiet. Second of all, she was not aware of the extent of the holdings that actually belonged to Shimon. She had only become aware of the fact that Shimon's own assets were only a small portion of total holdings after the death of Shimon. Now, she thought that they were equal partners, basically. She realized he only had a very small portion. And that which, and really he was, this will really was very significant. She didn't realize to the extent of what that will was the impact. Had she known that her late husband actually owned the vast majority of the partnership, it only became known much later, makes no sense that she would have remained silent and agreed to such a loss. This fact only became known after an audit of the books after Shimon's death, when Chana became the sole trustee of the estate, according to her brother-in-law's will. Chana also asked if she could be reimbursed from the estate for all of the expenses she bore in extricating the assets from the grasp of the emperor. She also asked if Rivka was responsible to reimburse her from her daughter's portion for all of the immense expenses that Chana had to bear in order to deal with the authorities in France and Italy. That I don't know if the daughter had to. Just as a summary of that tshuva. I mean, it keeps on going on, but I just summarize the last things. Many daughters have acted with valor, but Chana excels them all. I have not capriciously graced Chana, nor given domains to Sora. I have judged according to the laws was shown me by heaven through scholars and scholarly works. These are the words of the humble and fear of Moshe Bar Yosef of Trani. And basically, he upheld the bulk of her claim. As I said before, upon their arrival in Constantinople, the Jewish community immediately felt their gracious hand. The Nossi family supported the poor, established synagogues and yeshivas. One of their beneficiaries was Rav Yosef ibn Leib, or Marie ibn Leib, or Rival, one of the leading Torah scholars of the Ottoman Empire. He moved to Constantinople from his native Salonika after a series of tragedies where two of his sons died. One of them, Rav David, a 28-year-old brilliant Torah scholar, was killed by an assassin who was hired by a rich and powerful enemy of Rav Yosef ibn Leib. The other drowned in a river shortly afterwards. Shortly after he arrived in Constantinople, he was appointed to be Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva, which was established by Dona Gracia and Yosef Nossi. The Marival left over four volumes of response at Shuvas, as well as Chidushim, original insights, and a number of Talmudic tractates. In Turkey, the family branched out into tax farming, that is, tax collecting for profit. In addition, because of the Nossi family's tax and commercial interests, they developed a far-flung network of agents, functionaries, and correspondents. Because of his familiarity with European affairs, Don Yosef Nossi became an invaluable advisor to the Ottoman court. He played an important role in peace negotiations between the Ottoman Empire and Poland in the year 1562. In 1569, he encouraged the Dutch to rise up against their Spanish lords, promising them Ottoman assistance. I mean, eventually the Dutch became independent. That's the subject of a coming lecture. With the death of Suleiman in the year 1566, his son Selim II became the sultan. Soon afterwards, Selim raised him to the rank of Mutarferik, or gentleman of the imperial retinue, carried with him much honor as well as a handsome salary. Selim also elevated Yosef Nossi and made him duke over the island of Naxos in the Aegean Sea. He also gave him the adjacent islands of the Cyclades island chain, Andro, Paro, Antiparo, Milo, 12 islands in all, which Selim had only recently wrested from the Venetians, so thereby is also granting the title of Count of Andros. So he was a duke, he was a count. Not bad for a guy, probably also made a tenth of it for the minion, you know. As we stated before, because Malka Reina, or Brianda di Luna, sister of Gracia, made use of the French anti-Semite in her attempt to claim some of the Mende's wealth on behalf of her daughter, the French government was unwilling to repay the debt that it owed to the Mende's firm. As a result, Don Yosef obtained a firman, a royal decree which enabled him to seize any shipping carrying the French flag which entered any Turkish harbor. In addition, he sent privateers as far as Algiers to make a raid upon French merchant vessels. He finally succeeded in getting possession of several vessels in the port of Alexandria, captured all of the merchandise on board, and sold it to pay the debt which the French government owed him. The French protested vigorously against what they considered an illegal seizure, but in vain. The Sultan stood behind Don Yosef. As a result, the French greatly desired to take their revenge against Don Yosef. An opportunity soon presented itself. A Jewish physician by the name of Daoud, one of the physicians of the royal court, who was in the service of Don Yosef as a translator, evidently felt slighted and wronged by him. I don't know the exact details. But when the French ambassador found out about this, he offered this Daoud a sum of money and a place as an interpreter in the French embassy with a yearly salary. As his employee, the French ambassador prevailed upon him to betray Don Yosef to the Turkish Sultan. Daoud promised to furnish the French ambassador with documentation that Don Yosef sent daily information to the Pope, it's ridiculous, the King of Spain, the Duke of Florence, the Genoese Republic, the sworn enemies of the Sultan, and kept them constantly informed of all that was happening in the royal palace. In his excitement, the French ambassador sent a coded message to the King of France and the Queen Mother, Catherine de Medicis, that he would soon topple the Sultan's favorite and France would get its just revenge. In spite of that, of the secrecy that the French ambassador maintained, the plot was uncovered by Don Yosef. Prevailing upon the Sultan, Don Yosef obtained a decree by which the traitor Daoud was banished for life to the island of Rhodes, the criminal colony of the Turkish Empire. Soon afterwards, all of the rabbis and communities of Constantinople proclaimed a ban upon Daoud and two of his accomplices. And I have this on page 6. Time doesn't allow. A tshuva, a response about this, about how, to the extent has the excommunication, is it to be honored or not? As a result of the personal difficulties that he experienced, another area of the world in which Don Yosef had bad feelings was the Republic of Venice, the city which had imprisoned his mother-in-law and given him personal difficulties as well. After receiving news in 1571 that the Venetian arsenal at Cyprus had been destroyed by an explosion, Don Yosef urged Selim to wrest control of the island of Cyprus from the Venetians, who had controlled the island since 1489, to send the Turkish fleet. Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus, fell at the first assault. The other major city, Famagusta, was besieged. The Venetians, however, achieved a major victory at Lepanto, at the Gulf of Corinth, off the coast of Greece. It's a very famous battle, where a combined fleet of Spain, Venice, and Papal States, led by Don John of Austria, half-brother of King Philip of Spain, defeated the Turkish fleet. At this point, in December of 1571, the Venetians became emboldened and decided to take revenge upon Don Nossi and imprison all the Jews in Venice with plans to expel them under the pretext they were all co-conspirators of his. And that's really, this is the tshuva that I have. Again, you can look at it yourself. In page 7, about how they were in prison and their merchandise was impounded. Before they were able to bring their plans to fruition, though, Famagusta fell to the Turks. The Venetians were then forced to sue for peace and release the Jews from their imprisonment. In fact, the Turkish emissary that conducted the peace negotiations was of Shlomo ben Nosson Ashkenazi. As we're going to see when we get on the lecture about Poland, he was also a very powerful in the Polish court. And this incident had legal implications here, as described in this responsa here. Again, which you can look at yourself. Besides the mark that he made in the diplomatic and commercial spheres, Don Yosef put his efforts in rebuilding Eretz Yisrael and received the city of Tiberias, Tveria, under his jurisdiction. He planned that Tveria would become a haven for exiles from Christian lands like himself. At that time, Tveria was completely desolate, and the Tzfas we had discussed before was a major city. But Tveria was just a churban. The following is a contemporaneous account by Rav Yosef at Cohen in his work Emek HaBocha of the attempt to settle Tiberias. And this, we'll read this. This is taken from this. Don Yosef Nossi found favor in the eyes of Suleiman the king, who granted him the ruins of Tiberias, together with 7 surrounding towns, to be its nobleman and master. Don Yosef sent Rav Yosef ben Ardit to build the walls of the city, because that was important for protection. He gave him documents sealed by the royal seal and gave him orders to tell the Pasha, the governor in Damascus and Safed the following. Quote, whatever this man asks for, grant it to him, unquote. The royal order went out directing the skilled and unskilled laborers to come to Tiberias to rebuild it. At that time, an elderly Arab Sharif, chieftain, stood up and cried to the local natives, quote, don't let them build that city, for I have found in an ancient work that when the city will be rebuilt, our religion will be destroyed, end quote. It's another Baba Meisen. They refused to build the walls. Hearing this, the Pasha became incensed and immediately sent out troops to restore control. The workers then resumed digging the foundations for the wall. The wall was finally completed in the month of Kislev, in the year of 5325, 1564. Don Yosef ordered mulberry trees to be planted there in order to provide food for silkworms. He also ordered wool to be imported from Spain so they make clothing similar to that manufactured in Venice. So he wanted really to become a major center. Unfortunately, this attempt at resettling Tiberia was not successful. Eventually, after his lifetime, the city was abandoned. Don Yosef's influence lasted until the death of Selim II in 1574, and the succession of his son Murad III. He then retired to private life and devoted the rest of his life till his death in the year 1579 to the support of scholars in the Torah. With his death began a period of steady decline within the Turkish Empire, both politically and spiritually. Now, are there any questions? So the question is, were the Muranos important? Were they able to retain the practice of Mila? And the answer is no, they were not. Probably, my understanding is, I'm not aware of it. In other words, I don't know, it could be that the Rabbanim were also, I'm not sure, that I don't know. In other words, if the question was, did they have to go through a reconversion? If they were really certain that it went through a mother's line all the way, they would not need conversion. Perhaps there was a question, because there was intermarriage at large, so perhaps there was still perhaps a cloud of, but you know, that I don't know. Yeah, so the question of Mamzeris, of the thing of adultery. First of all, for Catholics, really, there's no question of adultery because there's no divorce. Second of all, and this is we discussed this in the previous lecture when the issues were first brought to light. For a kedushin, for a Jewish marriage to be valid, you need valid witnesses. And these were all in the presence of these people who were practicing Catholics. So there's another question of the validity of the marriage. Even if they would have performed, besides the Catholic ceremony, a true kedushin, there's a question of the validity of their, you know, of the witnesses. But I don't believe, I think it's a moot point in terms of adultery. It doesn't seem that we know much about this. In other words, there was not. It's really in a very remote section, and they really don't want to keep in the limelight. So it's really not certain have they continued on, but it is quite likely. In other words, they're not very educated, as in the, you know, in terms of, and they're probably the townspeople are still very religious Catholics. So it's quite possible that really nothing has changed.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.